Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling for Leighton Working Behind the Scenes. Coming up on today's show, we'll be joined by Eric Talley, Strategic Accounts at Stanley Security. Stanley, a lot of people familiar with the brand, but they are a leader in the retail security space. We're going to talk to Eric about everything from loss prevention to ensuring that fire response even is as quick as can possibly be for a retail store, as well as after-hours security. A lot of interesting topics come up during our conversation with him. In news, we're going to talk about a multitude of things today. Not only did several retailers release earnings, including CVS and the likes of Ingles Markets, but we'll talk also about Sprouts and Whole Foods a little bit later on in the show and look ahead to how a shortage of shipping containers might be affecting the holiday season for retailers. Our podcast is brought to you today by Quantum Metric. We'll talk more about them later on the show, but happy to have them as a partner with the Retail Focus Podcast. Now that we've previewed everything, the obligatory reminder that you can like us and rate us on any podcast listening platform you so choose. That could be Apple Podcasts, that could be Amazon itself, that could be Google's podcast platform, any of those, Spotify as well. Your ratings help others that are retail focused to find our podcast. See what I did there. You can also check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast. Leighton just uploaded a picture of a sunset over a Macy's in Novi, Michigan. So if you're into the scenic part of retail, that is up on the Instagram page as well. So we begin today's show with CVS as they announce strong front store sales in Q2, as we so often do when we talk about CVS, Walgreens, or Rite Aid. We'll tell you we're going to focus on front store sales. CVS has a ton of stuff going on, obviously, with the healthcare industry, but we're most focused on those retail sales. And what was interesting about their earnings call and maybe instructive to other retailers' future sales is the cadence of not only COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S., but COVID-19 testing in the U.S., and we'll get to that in a bit. As a background, though, for CVS, generally speaking, pandemic sales have been relatively strong, not just in pharmacy, but also their front store sales. It's been a bit of a rocky up and down situation numerically, simply because of the cadence of panic buying and so forth, but generally speaking, front store sales have been steadily increasing for them since last June. Now, this earnings call once again backed up the idea that customers continue to opt for convenience over price in some circumstances, particularly their pharmacy customers and their digital customers. You know, you have to wonder if those concerned about the Delta variant too might make a return to a less crowded CVS as they did during parts of last year, versus making a trip to a crowded general merchandiser or grocer. And if you've been to a Walmart or Target or Kroger or Albertsons recently, you know we've seen no drop off in traffic basically since the news of the Delta variant broke. An increase in masks, sure, but you have to wonder if some customers are going to start to worry a little bit about the populations in those stores. In any case, let's get to CVS's numbers. They saw company-wide revenue come in $72.6 billion for their second quarter. That's up 11.1% over last year. And that's a substantial jump for them, although, as we'll discuss, not all of it came from their retail operations. Meanwhile, they saw adjusted earnings per share, the entire company did, of $2.42, beating analyst expectations by 17%. Zacks consensus estimates had them pegged at $2.07 per share. Now, their operating income did decrease from last year, although this was a factor of low utilization levels in their healthcare benefits segment from a year ago, not really something that we discuss on the podcast. Their decrease in operating income did not come from their retail segment, which was actually up and helped to offset any decreases from the HCB program that CVS has. And specific to their retail business, total revenues for them came in at $3.07 billion over last year. About $1 billion of that was due to COVID vaccinations, but overall an increase of 14.2%. And generally speaking, as I mentioned, some of it came from COVID vaccination income, which they didn't see last year, but a variety of factors really fueling their retail sales. Increased script volume because people were actually getting prescriptions filled. They were holding off on it a little bit last year. Higher diagnostic testing revenue because people are coming into stores now for other things besides just COVID testing. Their diagnostic testing services in store helping to fuel their retail revenue. And of course, front store revenues were up. The company actually said they were actually up, those front store sales, across all product categories, further displaying their front store strength. They've been steadily growing over the past 3 to 4 years, generally speaking. Like I said earlier, they've had quarters where things have been down just because of the cadence of COVID effects. But generally, their front store has been in growth mode over the last 3 to 4 years, not as much as their pharmacy has, mind you, but still growth nonetheless. The quarter in which, if you look back, they were most adversely affected by COVID negatively in terms of effects regarding front store sales was the first quarter of this year. You look, comps were down 10.9%, and this was as a result of them lapping panic buying last March. In the second quarter of 2020, comps were down 4.5%, and that would probably be the second quarter where things were negatively impacted by COVID. However, this quarter saw comps bounce back in a big way, as we've seen in other quarters for them, increasing front store sales by 12%, and that's on the comp front. Overall front store sales were up 12.9% when you factor in new stores. Now, like I said, this is against the backdrop of a 4.5% decrease in the second quarter a year ago, but still the two-year stack looking very positive for CVS, and that's why we say in aggregate, it seems like they've been able to weather the COVID storm in a favorable fashion compared to their pharmacy brethren in Walgreens. And again, you have to look at that two-year stack, better shape at the end of the second quarter than they were in 2019. That's what we've been seeing from a lot of retailers in general, not just retail pharmacies. Now, a few brief notes from the call. Vaccination rates are slowing in some markets, but they note that testing for COVID continues at a decent pace, which is a revenue generator for them. Moreover, they said that 12% of the customers introduced to CVS through COVID testing actually chose to fill new scripts there or get their vaccine there. And so CVS feels somewhat confident that a portion of those testing, as testing rates are increasing, will return for one of those two things in the near future. They are also saying that vaccination rates, at least first-time vaccination rates, going up in certain markets as they held the call, didn't impact their second quarter, though, because the Delta variant is something that we've really seen crop up and increase over the past 3 weeks. Also, CVS said they're hedging their outlook regarding vaccination traffic after vaccination traffic came in lower than expected during May and June. But they noted the spread of the Delta variant and potential for also booster shots being required or recommended in the future by the FDA as things that might increase that vaccination traffic again. And they said even if vaccination traffic doesn't increase, the fact that testing traffic is increasing, this could also mean an increase in cough, cold, and flu product sales in front store during a time of year where historically in August and September, those products really haven't been super popular, but this has ripple effects too, including a potential need for increased staffing if trends continue, if more people continue to get tested for that Delta variant. They said nothing regarding COVID and the pharmacy sector happens in isolation. Everything has ripple effects, and that's something that CVS has their eyes peeled for. Regarding individual product categories, they don't really get into that too much during their calls, but they did note that almost two-thirds of the growth in front store revenues was due to health and wellness products. They did mention all categories, of course, up over last year. And during the call, they also announced the intention of increasing associates' minimum wage to $15 by 2022. CEO Karen Lynch noted that 65% of their hourly employees are already at or above this rate, so it's just a matter of getting the other 35% there. Most of the impacts are going to be felt around pharmacy techs and front store employees for CVS. The company will begin the series of increases starting this September, just 1 month from now, at the tune of about $125 million of an impact to their bottom line in the second half of the fiscal year to try and get everyone to that wage level. And finally, we found it interesting that they didn't note their new private label rollout for front store products or the impacts from it during the call. And granted, CVS has a lot to talk about during these earnings calls with the health and wellness aspect and the retail aspect both, as well as the pharmacy aspect. In May, though, CVS announced 150 new private label products having been launched, and that's a huge increase for a retailer with a limited number of SKUs compared to, say, Kroger or Albertsons, because we might have one of those two companies, say, release 400 new products in a quarter, and then that would be noteworthy. But as far as CVS is concerned, they did launch 150 new private label products. No update on how those are impacting front store sales or margins. I might add their leadership pretty good about talking just in generalities on calls, which is why we never get category comp breakdowns on the call. So even if someone had asked about it, not sure they were going to bring it up, but certainly something to keep an eye on potentially for future earnings calls as CVS continues to build out their private label product selection, something that we've seen Rite Aid, by the way, be very bullish on over the last year plus. Well, that'll do it for the first segment of the podcast this week. Coming up after this break, we'll be joined by Eric Talley of Stanley Security. We're going to talk to Eric about everything regarding retail loss prevention and security. That includes video surveillance, that includes security when the store is open, it includes an increase in theft over the last year and what retailers can do to help to stem that off, as well as new technologies that are being used in this space. I mentioned it in the beginning, but we've got a new partner on the podcast. I'm super excited about this, and I want to talk specifically to all the digital leaders out there in retail. How would it feel to not only know what your customer's experiencing, but how many others are experiencing that same thing too? I think it's about time that everyone put customers at the center of decisions. Everyone talks about being customer-centric, but really sometimes that doesn't work out. But I think it's time we do that. We put customers at the center of decisions and get ahead with real-time insights way before a code freeze. And, you know, it may be warm outside in most areas of the country, but, you know, for retailers, the holiday season has already begun. We're going to talk about that in the second half of the show. Obviously, your eyes have to be on that holiday season to get a jump. 2021 holiday e-commerce sales are expected to exceed 2020 benchmarks. No surprise there for those that are listening to the podcast on a regular basis. And you should be prepared to capture every customer revenue opportunity with Quantum Metric. You can be their unique approach to the digital customer experience helps today's top retailers and e-commerce brands quickly identify and prioritize the big and small revenue opportunities that keep customers engaged and coming back. Talking about continuous product design here, they help retailers we talk about all the time on the show. Tractor Supply Company, one of the favorites of the show, Joanne, among many others. Why not yours? You should join them. Stay off the naughty list this holiday season by reducing customer friction, increasing conversions, and personalizing the shopping experience. Everyone wants to personalize the shopping experience. Their metrics can help you do that. If you want a sneak peek, you can visit them at quantummetric.com/podoffer. That's all one word, pod offer, and see if you qualify to receive their 12 days of insights offer with the code RETAILFOCUS. Again, all one word. This offer gives you 12-day access to their platform coupled with a bespoke insight report that will help you identify where customers are struggling or engaging in your digital product. Restrictions apply. You could check out the show notes if you missed that URL. We'll put it in the show notes. Really excited to have them on board as a partner of the show. Once again, quantummetric.com/podoffer. You can use the code RETAILFOCUS. It's right there in the promo code category, right underneath company name. Put in RETAILFOCUS and see if you're eligible for the 12 days of insights offer. Among all the topics often talked about in retail stores amongst management, loss prevention is near the top. Yet, theft prevention and security as it pertains to retail is rarely discussed in the retail media. And we're going to change that today as we're pleased to be joined by Eric Talley, Strategic Accounts of Stanley Security. Stanley is a leader in the retail security space, providing various retail loss prevention solutions, including real-time location systems, visitor management, and of course, the basics like intrusion systems and alarms. Eric, thank you for joining the show today.
Thanks for having me, Trent.
First, I think a lot of people are likely familiar with the Stanley brand name, but I'd guess a good portion of our audience, at least those that don't work in retail intimately, might be unfamiliar with their retail security services. I was wondering if you could give us a bit of an overview as to some of the services that Stanley Security offers retailers, just for perspective.
Yeah. Like you mentioned, so Stanley Black & Decker as a whole obviously has a lot of name recognition, but Stanley started back in 1843. We made door hardware like hinges and bolts. And then obviously in the 175 years plus since, we've grown the technology around securing doors and facilities quite a bit. Some of that's organic, some of it's been key mergers and acquisitions along the way, but now we're one of the leading security providers in the world. In the retail sector specifically, we protect people, product, and facilities through multiple avenues. The most vital and probably the easiest to spot when you're out shopping would be video surveillance. But I can talk a little about intrusion alarms, fire alarms, access control, and then some professional services like how those systems are monitored, the analytics that we can use in conjunction with those systems, as well as some cybersecurity concerns.
There are a number of factors behind this, of course, but retail theft reached a record high last year. What is the current state of theft in the retail industry?
You know, last year kind of created the perfect storm for that increase. So it jumped from around $50 billion to $61.7 billion. The pandemic caused an economic wave that was hard to ignore. There were people losing their jobs, reaching new levels of desperation. And then retailers were reducing staffing due to the reduced store traffic and revenue at the same time. So those two kind of combined to see that increase. We're hopefully coming out of this now. We're seeing retailers kind of beef back up on how many people they've got in stores to meet the new demand. So hope to see a decrease in that trend this year.
I think when it comes to discussion about loss prevention, usually that discussion starts with theft, whether that be external or internal, but at least in terms of external theft, what are some retailers doing kind of in the here and now to combat that and keep from adding to those numbers you were just discussing?
Well, you know, with regards to what solutions can help them, you know, video is obviously the first one that comes to mind. Having adequate coverage around your store, reducing blind spots wherever you can, and then making them visible. Let people know that surveillance is there. Use signage, have the cameras out in place so people can see them. Hidden cameras aren't a deterrent. They'll let you confirm that you lost what you think you lost, but visible cameras, you know, around a store, covering all the aisles, that kind of thing, well, that helps deter, makes people think twice. And then, of course, we've seen an advance in that technology over the last 5 to 10 years. A decade ago, you were identifying an individual as a, for example, a male with a green shirt and not much else. That's pretty much what you had to go on. But now using higher resolution cameras and some analytics software, not only are you able to identify more characteristics of somebody that may be stealing from you, but you can use analytics to find where else that individual was in the store, whether or not they took something else, and possibly catch them even before they try to leave.
So let's talk a little bit about those advances in that camera technology, especially over the last 5 years, because high definition, high resolution cameras, that of course takes infrastructure to support. And when you compare those to the old grainy, oftentimes black and white cameras there, what are some things that retailers have had to do or consider maybe on the infrastructure end of it to ensure that they're where they need to be in order to accommodate the higher resolution systems?
Well, the good news is that most of that infrastructure is likely already in place because it's all IP-based now. So the old grainy cameras that you were talking about were analog. They were run with a specific cable. Now, it's as long as you have PoE, power over Ethernet, as long as you have those ports, then you can put high-definition cameras all over your facility. So the infrastructure key, you know, the part of that is actually the easier part because more than likely you already have that infrastructure in place for other internet IoT things around your facility.
While we're on the topic of video surveillance, I think one of the big topics, especially among customers of retail stores, is the issue of privacy. It seems like anytime someone brings up video surveillance, the issue of privacy comes up. What are some of the safeguards in place, or what are some of the mechanisms in place to ensure that the regular non-theft committing customer, if you will, is at ease with the surveillance situation in the stores?
Well, you know, honestly, it's such a part of the retail environment now that you'd be hard pressed to find a big retailer that doesn't have security and, you know, some kind of surveillance in place. I would say that it's something that you're never going to fully get over, people's concern over privacy, but truthfully, that's not what the systems are there for. It's not to just monitor your daily shopping activities, although that is a feature that stores can use, you know, but it's sometimes to your benefit. So understand that these cameras are also, they can also analyze how long you're having to wait in a store to check out. Those are the kind of things that they're also trying to analyze because they want to make the shopping experience better for the people visiting the store. So all of this is taken into account, but there isn't like software that is saying, hey, Trent is coming into Best Buy three times a week and looking at TVs. Let's send him that. We're not there. We're just not. What they are looking at is, hey, we put this TV on display and we've had 72 people in the last 4 days stop and take a look. Maybe we should make a bigger deal out of this TV.
And you bring up a good point because it's not always about just, hey, finding someone that might be committing a crime in the store. There are a lot of fringe benefits that retailers can glean from these type of systems, a lot of analytics, a lot of data that they can get from these systems, as well as, you know, obviously contact tracing has been big, of course, with the pandemic. What are some of the things outside of just finding shoplifters that retailers can glean from these type of systems?
I would say a lot of the analytics now are not just for, and I'm sure we're going to touch on this, but it's not just for external theft. You know, some of this is addressing internal theft, what's happening at registers, sweethearting and stuff like that. So it can work in conjunction with anything. So it can find, hey, this is a high traffic area of the store, or this is the entrance that most people use. So for example, over the last year, most retail environments you're going into, you're seeing a hand sanitizing station, maybe some masks or something that people are able to use prior to going into the store. So retail environments can say, hey, 80% of our traffic comes in this entrance. So this is the one that we need to make sure we are refilling every day. This is an area that needs to be cleaned more thoroughly. And that kind of stuff is, you know, not just the right thing to do amidst a pandemic, but anytime, but it's also highly marketable. You're able to show people that you're creating a clean, safe environment for the shoppers as well.
To this point, we've talked a little bit about external theft, but internal theft is a significant issue as well. It's not just people outside the company that might be shoplifting, let's say. So to what extent is internal theft affecting retailers currently? And are there other forms of theft that just in general might fly under the radar for those on the outside looking in terms of retail?
Yeah, you know, internal theft is actually responsible for a large portion of that total dollar loss that I mentioned earlier. So as an example, the average internal theft is around close to $2,000 per incident, while, you know, an external is around between $400 and $450. So you can see it's a larger amount. And it's more difficult to pick out because employees know the systems in place. So if I'm just a guy coming in to steal something from a store, I may see a couple of cameras, but I might miss something. Whereas an employee is in there every day, they may know where the blind spots are. Your employees might have even seen your camera array on a screen and know exactly what it's looking at and what it's not. Sometimes that's not locked up the way it's supposed to be and people can see it. So I mentioned sweethearting earlier. So if you don't know, sweethearting is where someone will have somebody come into shop and they'll bring some items up to the register or something, and they'll only check out one or two of them and put five or six in a bag. All right. So that kind of thing is really hard to detect just by looking at video footage. Whereas there are systems that integrate between the video and the POS system to do what we call exception-based reporting. So for example, if you void something on a transaction, if you refund something, all of that is sent to a manager with the video clip so that the manager can see, okay, this void was real. It wasn't somebody scanning a $60 item and then voiding it and putting it in the bag. So that's the kind of stuff that you can do to help with sweethearting and just the internal theft. But also, we talk about camera systems around your facility, and we think like, hey, it just needs to be on the retail floor where your customers are. But truthfully, you have to have just as good coverage in your warehouse and storage spaces, because that's where your employees have access to this stock. So if your camera array is just protecting the front, then the back of the house, as they would call it, is a lot more open to theft internally.
To this point, we've discussed retail theft as it pertains to security, but one of the things that often goes overlooked a lot is the responsibility of retail stores to keep their staff safe. And of course, the last year plus or so, we've thought of this in terms of COVID, but there are a lot of other considerations here too. What are some solutions that retailers leverage to ensure that their employees not only feel safe, but have the correct tools in place in the case of an emergency or some incident at the retail store?
Yeah, so this gets into some of the professional services that I mentioned, but obviously you can have a camera system in place, and a camera system by itself allows for evidence after the fact. But a monitored camera system, and one that is linked to a monitoring center specifically that does this full time 24/7, gives you some more options. So obviously there's a panic button kind of device that will link to this system. We've seen this for years in, you know, for example, like the banking community, they've got them under the desks or wherever, but we're putting them in retail environments so that if there is an incident, the employee can hit the panic button or hit, you know, wherever it is around the register behind the desk. And our monitoring center can look in, not just look in and call for a response from local police, but if you choose, we can also come over the speaker. It's, of course, additional systems, but when you have a speaker in place, we can come over the speaker and say, this location is being monitored by Stanley Security. Police have been asked to respond. That kind of thing can let somebody know that, like, hey, it's not just you and this employee. Now you are in a situation where we are recording this event and we've already called for police response. So it takes some of the pressure off of the employee who may not be in a position to relay that information themselves.
And something else that you brought up in the introduction is something that oftentimes is not top of mind necessarily for retailers, but that is fire, whether it be mitigation or response. What are some of the mechanisms retailers have in place to not only mitigate these concerns, but also ensure fast response through whether it be monitoring or other systems?
Yeah, so, you know, fire response is typically pretty immediate, all right? Like when a fire alarm goes off in a retail environment, we immediately alert authorities, local authorities to that location. Fire trucks go. There aren't false alarms in fire aren't as prevalent as they are in intrusion. So typically when there's an alarm, fire trucks go, they respond, they'll get to it as quickly as they possibly can. That's not always the case with false alarms and intrusion. I'm happy to touch on that a little bit too, because that is something that is a definite concern. You know, we've talked about during hours stuff, but there's also after hours theft. So, but yeah, with fire, it's typically smoke or heat sensors that immediately alert our monitoring center.
Yeah, let's talk about that after hours theft, because again, I think if you work in retail, that's something that you're very, very aware of is break-ins after hours. But again, theft, shoplifting takes most of the headlines. What are some of the things in 2021 that retailers have been doing or can do to mitigate these type of circumstances, but also ensure that response is quick by authorities?
Yeah, the pandemic saw a rise in after-hours break-ins as well to many retailers. A lot of that was because the reduced hours they were open, whereas, you know, a retail environment used to close at maybe 9 or 10, would open back up the next morning at 8 or 9. As I'm sure you saw, a lot of places were closing at 6, and then they weren't opening until 10 or 11. Reduced hours, that means more time where people could try to make this happen. So it's unfortunate. This number is slowly improving, but false alarms still make up over 90% of alarm activity. And local police know this. They know that most of the alarms they are responding to are false. It can be anything from a balloon got off a display and set off a motion. It can be, you know, the air conditioning turned on and moved something on a display and set it off. There are any number of things that could set off a false alarm. And because of this, they respond. It's not an immediate priority when they get an alarm. However, video verification is something that we employ with our customers, and that just means that we can sound a verified alarm. So the alarm comes to our monitoring center. We look in on the cameras, and we can verify whether or not there is actually an intruder or whether or not it is something false, in which case we can reset the alarm or we can let store management know that, hey, you had a false alarm. All of that's up to the retail environment, how they want their chain of response set. But when we call in a verified alarm, police hit lights and they go because they know for sure there is somebody in a space they are not supposed to be in. You know, it causes a quicker response and lessens the chance for damage at your location.
Certainly cuts down the boy who cried wolf effect just a little bit, I would think. I wanted to ask you, because you're someone, again, that works with retailers on a day-to-day basis, connects with retailers about these solutions. When a retailer approaches a company like Stanley Security, what's top of mind for the retailer? What's that dialogue like as you determine what that retailer is looking for and what system might work best for that individual retailer?
Obviously, one of the first things that comes up is like, hey, we need systems that protect our people, protect our facilities, but at the same time aren't detrimental to our shopping experience. All right. So people don't want to feel like they're shopping in a prison. You know, they want the freedom to shop. Everything needs to be marketable and look nice. So that's one of the first things that comes up. But I would say false alarms are one of the second most talked about, because anybody that has worked in retail has been a store manager or an assistant manager that gets a call at 2 a.m. that something has happened at your store to find out that nothing really did. So that's probably the second biggest thing that we address are false alarms.
We've talked a lot about the present in terms of theft prevention, loss prevention, all of that. What is the future as it pertains to loss prevention, theft prevention, and the like?
Yeah, you know, so electronic security as a whole has made advancements that help retailers protect their staff and inventory, but we're far from our peak here. Every time we think we've seen the best cameras, the best analytics, they tend to improve year to year. So new technology being utilized in the future will give them the opportunity to grow their business while protecting it. So you're talking camera streams to identify areas of growth, the bottlenecks and the checkout lines and shopping areas, customer flow through the business presents marketing opportunities, all of that. And I would say the biggest thing, if we're talking about future protection and future security, is a cybersecurity aspect. So we talk a lot about how video surveillance and access control can limit access and theft in store. But probably one of the bigger concerns that retailers, especially small retailers now, are encountering is cyber theft. So most of your credit transactions, your POS transactions, are coming over the internet. Somebody that can hack your network and sit in there and gather credit cards for a week, they never have to touch your facility. They could be in another state. They could be in another country. They get all of your customers' credit cards, and then you have to send out one of those unfortunate emails that I'm sure we've all gotten at some point that says, we apologize, but while shopping in our store, your credit card information was compromised. Note, that doesn't look good for anybody. It doesn't feel good as a consumer. It doesn't feel good to send that email as a retailer. So that's the kind of thing that people are going to have to start addressing more, is that network protection aspect of this that says, I have to protect my people, my inventory, my facility, and my data. Because the data is probably the most sought thing that you have in your store.
Certainly so many things to be mindful of as we head full on into the 2020s. Well, once again, Eric Talley, Strategic Accounts at Stanley Security, thank you so much for joining us today discussing matters of retail loss prevention.
Thank you, Trent.
We thank Eric for joining us on the show. We like to circle back to loss prevention a couple of times a year if we can, because it is a category in retail, just like so much out there, that has really developed over the past 5 to 6 years. You know, 5, 6 years ago, we were still seeing plainclothes loss prevention managers wandering around the store. Not a whole lot else now. You see all kinds of security measures implemented. And as Eric mentioned, it's not just about keeping theft down. It's also about the idea of protecting your associates. We talk so much about increasing the minimum wage for associates and the like, but really, you want your associates to feel safe. And he said that's the first thing on every retailer's mind is to ensure associate safety. So great insight on the industry there. Now, a quick story is Leighton wanted to make sure that we talked about this on the show. Is there was actually a lot of grocery news this week, but Sprouts released not only earnings, but clarity on some of their store initiatives this week as they ramp up store construction once again. Now, their sales in this most recent quarter, which would be their second quarter of 2021, did flag somewhat, but they're the first grocery retailer we've seen come in on a negative two-year stack, largely due to lower than average increases last year versus the rest of grocery during that pandemic buying. But their comp sales going down 10% in this year's second quarter didn't help, and that meant two-year stack comps were actually down 0.6% in an atmosphere where we're seeing most two-year stack comps come in high single digits to low double digits across the board. So a worrisome trend here for a company that did spend the last half of the 2010s as one of the darlings of the grocery world. Now, that being said, they did post earnings per share of 52 cents, which compares favorably to the 30 cents they posted back in Q2 of 2019. So profit up for them, gross profit up 330 basis points, in fact, compared to 2019. So looking at that two-year stack there, as a result of the sales losses, they did revise guidance and they now expect comps to fall in 2021 in aggregate for the year by around 5-7%. That's to be offset somewhat in terms of top line revenue by new store growth. And speaking of that new store growth, one of the characteristics of Sprouts, pre-pandemic at least, was the rate at which they were opening new stores and entering new markets. That rate was much higher than most grocers out there. Now they're seeing a re-acceleration in plans of store count growth. The chain opened just one new store during this past quarter. That did bring their total to 363 stores, which is a significant increase over, let's say, 2018. However, they do expect to open a total of 9 new stores during the last two quarters of the fiscal year, putting them back on an expansion track similar to what we're used to seeing from them. They did caution, though, that they're having a tougher time opening new stores, which is interesting because this isn't something we've heard from the likes of, say, a Dollar General, who is generally seen as the brick-and-mortar growth leader, usually four digits in new stores year over year. But this is as a result of supply chain delays. We're not talking about product here, but rather construction materials. So having a difficult time getting those construction materials in to finish the build-outs of these new stores. So they mentioned some of these 9 new stores planned for the second half of the year. Openings might be pushed out just a bit. That is yet to be seen. They did note, though, that their new store footprints have been refined, at least for Sprouts. So they're decreasing overall footprint of the store, but increasing customer floor space. So basically, you're refining stock rooms and offices here and really decreasing that square footage, which for Sprouts can be all over the map, just depending on which location they're taking over and whether it's a build-to-suit or not. But the net effect for Sprouts is that the stores cost around 20% less for them to construct. That, in turn, of course, reduces that new store payback period for them. Now, a big customer-facing topic on the call was their continued rollout of what they call innovation centers. This does have to do with the store layout as well. These are areas in the store designed to highlight new products and what they call attribute-driven items. Basically, think plant-based type items, if you will. All of their new stores will have these innovation centers, but they did mention on the call a good amount of their existing stores, not just those stores that are being completely renovated, but a good amount of their existing stores that aren't undergoing complete renovation will be retrofitted with these innovation centers by year end. And finally, the company discussed produce. That's a key driver for them. Two new produce-centric distribution centers were opened in the quarter, one in Colorado and one in Florida. And as a consequence, their CEO, Jack Sinclair, said that 85% of their stores are now within 250 miles of a distribution center. Now, granted, this is also because they do have a tighter hub model. I liken them to Aldi. DCs often accompany entries for Sprouts into new markets. So Sprouts usually expands market by market. So rather than saying, hey, we're going to open up one store in, say, Kansas City, Missouri, they're going to say, hey, we're going to start the entry into the Kansas City metro area, and we plan to have, let's say, 15 stores there by the end of 2 or 3 years from now. Usually that distribution center comes along with that, or it's close enough to an existing distribution center. So they kind of plan things out in a similar way, not exactly, but a similar way to how Aldi plans to introduce themselves to various markets throughout the country. A couple of other quick notes. Local produce said to make up now 20% of produce offerings for Sprouts during the growing seasons in their respective markets. So that's a big thing for consumers that are worried about the carbon footprint, worried about buying local, especially as their competitor Whole Foods has seen less of that over the last few years, particularly since the Amazon takeover. It's a 300% increase for Sprouts versus prior years. And finally, organics penetration continues to be high for them. 35% of produce sales for them are organic. That, of course, helps out the top line because those organics come at a higher price point typically. However, they did mention on the call they plan on making price investments where they can in organics or drive supplier price down so that they can get those organics prices in line with conventionally raised produce prices. Now, two quick other grocery stores that caught our eye this week that Leighton tossed in here, he wanted me to mention. A hint from Amazon that Whole Foods' delivery platform is proving unprofitable in some markets. Now, they're piloting a $10 delivery charge for Prime members to get groceries delivered in Boston, Chicago, and some markets in New England. Technically, this is $9.95 of a delivery charge, to be exact. But previously, orders over $35 were free to have delivered for Prime customers. The way Whole Foods is spinning it here is they'd rather charge for delivery than increase food prices across the board for all their customers. And one other story, Ingles, a favorite of the show, and of course a retailer we talked about a lot in late spring as I visited the Asheville, North Carolina area where they're based. They released their earnings this week. They managed to keep comps actually close to last year. The comps just fell half a percentage point for their third quarter. They were actually up if you include fuel. However, their comps are up 23% on a two-year stack, which is fantastic. We talked at the beginning of the Sprouts story about retailers, grocers at least, coming in maybe low teens, maybe high single digits on a two-year stack, but 23%, very impressive for Ingles. Overall net sales for them were up 7.4%, helped out by those fuel sales I talked about and the opening of one new store versus last year. Grocery transaction count was up 8.2%, basket size down an even 8%. And this was expected given that customers are making more frequent trips without that hoarding activity we were seeing going on during last year's late spring and early summer.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast. We call it Looking Ahead, and this week we're looking ahead to a shipping container crisis. At least that's what Forbes is calling it. A good article from Joan Verden via Forbes talks a little bit this week about toy manufacturers feeling a crunch because of the cost of shipping containers. And the article says that toy makers, and this is specific to toys at least, are being charged $20 to $25K for 40-foot containers, those standard shipping containers that you see. They typically would have cost $3,000 to $4,000. So this is another aspect of supply chain that we talk about, not only a shortage of labor, but now a shortage of shipping containers. The article on Forbes goes on to discuss the impact to toy makers, specifically as it pertains to big versus small toy makers, how bigger toy makers have more leverage as far as these shipping containers are concerned. But of course, we're looking ahead to how this is going to affect holiday sales in retail, because of course, toy sales go up during the holiday season. This year is expected to be potentially another robust holiday season where we've seen year-over-year increases generally for the last several years. So how do retailers handle this? Now, it could be said that toy makers might increase the MSRP on their toys. Is that something that trickles down to retailers, or retailers will uphold? Will retailers make pricing adjustments there? And how does this affect the consumers' buying habits as they head into the holiday season? Will a family continue to spend, say, $100 on toys regardless of how many pieces that buys? Or will they pony up the extra money to ensure that just as many pieces as they would have bought last year are under the Christmas tree or given for holiday celebrations, as the case is? I think this is interesting because we've seen retailers crow generally about increased toy sales over the last few years. Part of that is because of consolidation in the industry after the bankruptcy of Toys R Us and the closure of other retailers. Part of that is because of just increased spending, like what we saw in the holiday season in 2020, as people had more of that discretionary income to spend because they weren't spending it on eating at restaurants, they weren't spending it on experiential things, they weren't spending it on traveling. So this looks like, at least on the surface, it could be a perfect storm for maybe those toy sales to take a step back this year if toy costs are going up for retailers and retailers plan on increasing their prices to the consumers. But very anxious to see how retailers are approaching the holiday season. And of course, we'll talk to our data gurus, no doubt, about the holiday season coming up. We always feature numbers from the likes of Deloitte and Cardlytics on the show, but anxious to see how that's going to be affected. And one last thing is that the article on Forbes mentions trying to get the message out to consumers to get their holiday shopping done early, because if you don't have it done by Thanksgiving, those toys might not be around for the last month of the year because of these supply chain issues and because of these shipping issues. So you wonder if customers are going to listen to that once again this year. And just like last year, where we saw an increase in that shopping cadence towards October rather than towards last-minute shopping, you wonder if that's going to come to bear again in 2021 as consumers start to worry about whether toys will be in the stores if they put off their shopping for the last minute. Well, that'll do it for our podcast this week. A big thanks to Leighton helping out behind the scenes. And once again, a big shout out to Quantum Metric, the new podcast partner for our next few weeks. Happy to have them on board. And again, you can check them out, quantummetric.com/podoffer. There's a video there, talks about everything that they do as a company. And you can, of course, click that link in the show description as well. Until next week, I'm Trent, saying so long.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.